Welcome to the latest episode of the IA School of Thought series with me, Sai Kamal. Now, this series is based on the IA book, School of Thought, 101 Great Liberal Thinkers by Eamon Butler, which, as the title suggests, summarises the thoughts of leading classical liberal thinkers on a range of issues and discusses them within a modern context. All the episodes in this series and our online content can be found at the IA YouTube channel, IA London, or on Podbean, or on our website, ia.org.uk. Today's featured thinker is liberal feminist and social reformer, Josephine Butler. And I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Steve Davies, who is a historian and head of education at the IA, to discuss her life and her work. Steve, welcome, and thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
I wonder if I can start off by asking, what inspired you to choose Josephine Butler? Have you specifically admired her role in the way she shaped our thinking? Was there something that she did? Is there a personal connection? What was it that inspired you?
Well, I am an enormous fan of Josephine Butler. She is a historical figure that I profoundly admire for both her personal qualities and for what she achieved. She's a great liberal thinker, a liberal, but also a feminist who combines the two ideologies in a very interesting way. She's also a great activist, a campaigner, responsible for one of the great libertarian campaigns of the 19th century. And she's also a profoundly original thinker. Towards the end of her life, she departs from what you might call the classical liberal orthodoxy on a very important issue, the question of what was going on in the Boer War. She's personally an admirable woman, a great liberal, a great human being, a great woman, basically, with a fascinating personal life story. So I think that she's both an interesting figure, but also one of great significance.
Well, why don't you tell our viewers and listeners a bit about her? Tell us a bit about her life. Yeah. Tell us a bit about, you know, what was it that she, in particular, that she agitated or was an activist on, and how she influenced liberal thinking?
Right. Well, she was an enormously important figure at the time, and when she died in 1906, she was obituarized in all the major journals. She was an extremely well-known figure. Millicent Fawcett, the great campaigner for the Votes for Women, described her as the most distinguished public woman of the 19th century, and most people would have agreed with that. But until very recently, she's been largely forgotten. So she was born in 1828, and for the first part of her life, really, up until 1869, although she had very strong political views, she wasn't actually involved in public life. She lived in various places with her husband, George Butler, who was a Anglican cleric and a distinguished intellectual figure in his own right. But then in 1869, she suffered a tragedy 1864 that was, when her five-year-old youngest child fell off the banisters at her home, fell 40 feet onto a stone floor and died. And that personal tragedy spurred her to get involved in public campaigning. Now, she described rather entertainingly how prior to that, she'd often had to sit through meetings where Oxford dons had discussed things like novels about women, and she was quietly, silently seething at the kind of double standards and misogyny that was being casually tossed around. Her response, she says, was to speak little with men but much with God, which is an interesting reaction. But what she did was that in 1869, she became involved in the campaign that is most associated with her, which was the campaign against the Contagious Diseases Acts. And she founded something called the National Ladies Association for the Repeal of the Contagious Diseases Acts, which is one of the great Victorian campaigning organizations. Now, what was this and why did she get involved? Well, the Contagious Diseases Acts were a series of acts passed in the 1860s to try and deal with the problem of venereal disease among British soldiers and sailors. And what it did was to put the blame for this entirely upon women, not just prostitutes, but women in general. And what the Acts provided for was that in a number of specified towns, any woman who was found on her own in the public could be arrested and detained, taken to a police station, given a forcible medical examination, and thereafter be registered as a common prostitute. And the idea was that this completely egregious violation of the process of law and due process and human rights was going to be extended to the entire country. The Third Act, which was passed in 1869, had a provision for the minister responsible, the Home Secretary, to gradually extend the scope of the legislation to cover the entire country. And it was thought of as a way of dealing with what was thought of as a big social problem. And her attack upon this combined, in a way that was typical of her, both liberalism, opposition to the intrusive power of the state, an emphasis upon personal responsibility, personal liberty, and the rule of law, with feminism, and in particular, a critique of the dual standard of sexual morality by which women were held to a higher and more stringent standard of sexual behaviour than men were. And so what you had was a great campaign which she undertook, which went on for almost two decades, involving a lot of personal danger on her part, because lots of people, brothel keepers and brothel owners, reacted very violently to her campaigns, and she was subject to all kinds of harassment and attack at the various public meetings that she held. And eventually in 1883, the laws were suspended. In 1886, they were actually repealed. So the campaign was ultimately successful. She was also involved in other campaigns at the same time, notably for the abolition of what was called the Law of Couverture, which was the law which stated that when a woman got married, her legal personality was extinguished and she became effectively an appanage or attachment of her husband. She had no separate legal identity. And in particular, all of her property became the property of her husband. It passed entirely to him. And you could get round this, but it required an incredibly expensive procedure, which was not available to anybody apart from the aristocracy, basically. And so she was also involved in the campaign to repeal that, which bore fruit again in 1886 with the passage of the Married Women's Property Act, which allowed women to retain their own legal distinct personality and interests after they were married.
So she was clearly an activist. We would call her a liberal activist.
Yeah.
Was she also seen as a thinker or a writer? And did she write much, and did she influence others?
She wrote an enormous amount. Nobody, I think, has actually produced a proper comprehensive bibliography of all of her writings. There's about 90, at least, short books, quite long books, pamphlets, published speeches, things of that sort. She wrote an enormous amount, and it's a mixture of short-term campaigning literature, longer, more reflective theoretical pieces, and also autobiographical memoirs of one kind and another. And she's both a campaigner but also a thinker, because she thought very deeply about feminism, but also about her concept of liberty, the nature of the British Constitution, the nature of what a free society was, and also, very importantly, about how both of those things related to her very profound and devout Christianity, which was of a non-denominational kind, by the way. Her husband was an Anglican cleric, but she herself was rather critical of the Church of England, but without joining another denomination. So she remained a very devout Christian, but of a non-denominational kind. Now, I think this is the area where the current historiography, which is quite good, by the way, Judith Walkowitz and other people have written about her, tends to miss out a lot of what is important about her, because her feminism, her feminist thinking has been studied quite a lot lately, and we now know quite a lot about how she thought about this and the nature of her feminism. But the other two big elements of her thought, the radical liberalism and the Christianity, are both overlooked. They just don't get explored in the same way. But for her, all three things were knit together into quite an extensive and systematic body of thinking. She saw the one part of her thought as supporting or entailing or implying the other, basically.
Now, when I speak to liberal feminists today, when I say liberal, I mean in a classical liberal sense rather than the modern American liberal sense. Many of them say to me the problem with the whole discourse or debate on feminism is that it's very dominated by modern liberals or feminists on the left. Yeah. How influential do you think she has been in terms of, that, first of all, the whole feminist debate, and secondly, in terms of shaping the classical liberal narrative?
Well, at the time, she was very, in terms of the second part of your question, at the time, she was very influential. One of the things that we forget now is that up until really the suffragette campaign before World War I, Feminism is mainly associated with radical laissez-faire liberalism. Most of the great 19th century feminists in both Britain and North America, and indeed also in France, are ardent individualists. And Josephine Butler fits right in the middle of that tradition. And so by the time you get to, say, the 1900s, the time of her death, feminism of that kind is associated with radical liberalism. It's seen very much as being part of a package deal, if you will. But that's tended to be forgotten later on. Now, her feminism is actually very radical because at the heart of it is a very profound critique of the sexual double standard that I mentioned earlier, and a critique, therefore, of conventional ways of understanding both male and female sexuality and sexual identity. So she's very radical in that respect, and that aspect of her thought has been revived by contemporary feminists, very much so. They look back to her as one of the influential founders of a lot of quite radical feminism today. But what the contemporary take on Butler by feminists does is to leave out the way that for her, this was also associated with radical individualism and therefore with an extremely robust and radical anti-statism. She was, even by the standards of her own time, a real hardline anti-statist. She was, you know, in the kind of Herbert Spencer class in terms of opposition to the expansive role of the state. So she didn't believe, for example, in a compulsory public police force. She was opposed to that. She thought that we should depend upon voluntary private action to enforce the law and protect property and lives from depredation. She was strongly anti-militarist, strongly opposed to imperialism. So she had a whole lot of radical individualist ideas, which these days tend to be discounted. So people buy part of the deal today. They're aware of her radical thinking about gender, but they miss out the fact that that for her is associated with a doctrine of individuality, individual independence and personal responsibility, which, as I say, also she ties in very much with her Christianity. And that leads her to what I think is her most important contribution to liberal thinking, which is a particular argument she has about how to carry out and bring about social reform.
So we know that she clearly is inspired by her own experiences, losing a child, her Christianity. Do we know what other or which other liberal thinkers might have inspired her, particularly in her writings?
Yes, she's strongly influenced by John Stuart Mill, who is himself, of course, an important figure in liberal feminism, first man to introduce a bill to give women the vote into Parliament. So she's strongly influenced by that kind of radical utilitarian liberalism that Mill typifies. But she's also very strongly influenced by the kind of radical Unitarian or radical Protestant strand within 19th century liberalism. People like W.J. Fox, for example, an early 19th century liberal figure who's a Unitarian cleric and major figure in liberalism of that sort. Also influenced by Elizabeth Gaskell, another person. We tend to think of Elizabeth Gaskell mainly as a writer, but she's also another major exponent of liberal views of various kinds, along with her husband. Those were big influences on her. So she's got a kind of, she's drawing on two separate streams, if you will. On the one hand, Mill, and through him, beyond him, Bentham and the philosophic radicals, but also, now I would say probably more importantly, the radical tradition of nonconformity, people like Edward Mile, W. Fox and others.
And do we know whether she, you know, which sort of contemporary writers or later writers that she inspired?
Well, she inspires lots of other feminists, basically. People like the person I mentioned, Millicent Garrett Fawcett, for example. She's a big influence on her. She's a big influence on people like lots of radical liberal politicians of the 1890s, 1900s, people like Labouchere, William Lawler, Joseph Sturge, other people of that sort. She's, as I say, she's quite a prominent figure in the life of her time, notorious in some senses because of her public campaigning. So she's a big influence on what you might call the mainstream of radical liberalism in the late 19th, early 20th century.
And what do you think, if classical liberals or libertarians were to read some of her works today, what do you think, what lessons do you think they could draw from it?
I think the big lesson to draw from it is the thing I alluded to, which is her take upon how to reform social problems, because she is opposed to things like the Contagious Diseases Acts, obviously, on both feminist and civil libertarian grounds, but she's also opposed generally to the institution of prostitution, which she regards as but morally repugnant, but also, very interestingly, as contrary to true individual independence and liberty, because the woman who is in that position is not free in a meaningful sense, Butler believes. But interestingly, she's first of all very strongly opposed to the state regulation of prostitution. So after she's managed to get the Contagious Diseases Act repealed, she spends most of the rest of her life organizing an international campaign against systems of state regulated prostitution. Now, that might lead you to believe that she's then in favor of the abolition of prostitution, but she's also against that. She doesn't think that the way to deal with this social phenomenon, this social problem, is by using the political process, the power of the state, to outlaw it. What she believes in instead is in a process of moral reform, where the focus is upon getting rid of a major social evil, reforming society, by a process of changing people's individual minds. It's a kind of early version, if you like, of the 12-step program, but also by voluntary action, mutual support, a general emphasis on personal responsibility, and also on changing the way people behave at an individual level, so that the sexual double standard is got rid of. So, for example, if we were to think about obvious contemporary applications of this, Butler would have been very much on the side of the, you know, exposure of sexual predators through the Me Too movement, but she would have been very strongly opposed to the idea that political action is the way to deal with this problem. She instead had a quite different model of how to achieve social reform and social transformation, which didn't involve the use of the state and legislation, much less the criminal law, to bring it about, which relied rather upon a process driven by voluntary action that changed what you might call broad popular psychology and culture. She took the same view about temperance, by the way, which is another major cause of the times. She supported temperance and the idea of either abstaining from drink or being very moderate in your consumption of it. But again, she was opposed to prohibition. She thought that the way to do this was again through moral reform at an individual but also collective level through voluntary action. And she works all this out in quite a lot of detail. And that, I think, is a very powerful insight. And it's an important way of thinking about issues like, for example, the war on drugs that you could very easily apply today.
Yes, and also very much a lot of classical liberals who are also religious quite often talk about the difference between the public sphere and the personal sphere. While they may choose to live their life in a particular way, they don't particularly want to impose it on others. When we look at look back at historical figures, there's a debate about how much we should view them in the context of their times. Was she very much someone of her time? Is there much that we would disagree with her today?
That's an interesting question. She is, in one sense, very much a creature of her time, as I think everyone is, obviously. The very devout evangelical Christianity, the idea that life should be governed by a very elevated moral purpose, I think that's very much part of the Victorian worldview, which you might not find today, or which we perhaps find it's not difficult to tune into, but it takes an effort to try and put yourself in that kind of mental world. On the other hand, in many ways, I think her principles and her insights are timeless. They're not purely of her time. So she's not a purely historical figure. She has a whole range of insights, which I think is still very, very much applicable. Her way of thinking is still very much part of the world. She was also in many ways rather ahead of her time. This was shown towards the end of her life when the big controversy in British politics was the Boer War and the way it was being conducted in South Africa. And many liberals were strongly opposed to the war and went to the point of being very much pro the Boers. This was Lloyd George's position, for example. So you had so-called pro-Boer liberals. And Josephine Butler, interestingly, dissented from the people she generally agreed with. And her view was, well, yes, the war is bad. The way it's being fought is really bad. But I'm not going to go and say that the Boers are the good guys, because they're not. And she made the point in a short pamphlet she wrote right towards the end of her life called Native Races and the War, that the people everyone was ignoring and not paying any attention to were the people who actually were the most important and the most at stake, which was the Native Africans, the Black Africans. And that the Boers, in fact, were much worse in terms of their attitudes towards them than were the largely Anglo-speaking population of the Cape Colony at Natal. And so she argued that basically she wasn't going to support Kitchener and his policies. On the other hand, she wasn't going to be totally opposed to the war either. And she thought that what they ought to do was focus rather on promoting racial equality before the law in South Africa after the war was over, which at the time was an almost unique position. And so she was very prescient in that and a long way ahead of her time. So she's both a creature of her time, but also somebody who put forward ideas and a way of thinking that I think is still completely relevant today. In fact, probably more relevant than ever in many ways. And also in some ways ahead of her time. And I'd like to read out of my mind a little passage from one of her little books, which I think captures a lot of what she said, thought, and which I think is more relevant now than ever. It's from a little pamphlet she published in 1879 called Government by Police. And she says at one point here, "Modern police government in its worst forms combines the evil of extreme centralization with the activity in every corner of the nation of a vast and numerous agency of surveillance, whose very presence tends to, by slow degrees, to enfeeble the sense of responsibility in the citizens in regard to the order and well-being of society." And the whole pamphlet, which I recommend everyone to read, is an amazing piece of radical libertarian attack upon what we would now call the tutelary or supervisory state. And it puts forward very clearly what she thinks the alternative to this is. And I think that's more relevant than ever.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it'd be very relevant, and particularly when there are also debates about the role of the police forces in our society, and there are campaigns about looking at alternatives. Now, you've told us a little bit about her as a person. You told us that she had a child who sadly died. You told us that she's married. What more do we know about her as a person? And, you know, how did she manage to, how did that inspire her?
Well, we do know a lot about her personal life, which is actually the case with a lot of these great Victorians, because, of course, they lived in the great age of letter writing. The telephone hadn't yet come along and made the historian's job a lot more difficult. She was very happily married. Her husband, George, was a great support to her throughout her life. And you can imagine that must have been quite difficult, because they had four children before Ava, the youngest, died. So there were still three children. And she was off out doing all kinds of stuff, campaigning. George had to keep the fort at home, basically, for a lot of that time. He actually died, interestingly, from influenza in the Russian flu pandemic of 1889 to 90. So that's rather interestingly relevant today. She had a whole network of friends. She was a great correspondent. She was somebody who made very strong friendships and connections very easily, if you will. And so she was at the network of a whole series of relations of one kind or another, as well as being a very devoted parent, but very much involved in public life in addition to that. She was apparently a woman of enormous dignity. One of the things that comes across from the contemporary accounts of her was that she commanded respect even from people who disagreed with her, not because of any obvious quality, but simply because of kind of almost unspoken quality of dignity that she had, which made people simply almost automatically treat her with respect. And she was also a person we know from the evidence of her writing and things, who was very much focused upon holding herself to a high moral standard. This again is very typical of her age, I think it's fair to say. And so she was very introspective in many ways. She was constantly thinking about whether what she did or said was the right thing to do, given the moral standards that she believed she should adhere to. And so the idea of personal responsibility, which was, I think, central to her political and social thought, was very much something she lived. It wasn't just a matter of something she believed. She actually practiced it.
So Steve, you've told us an enormous amount about Josephine Butler today and how many of her ideas are still relevant today, particularly when we think about issues of equality, people who struggle to have their voices heard, also about the role of the police and the role of the state. If you were to sum her up for our listeners and viewers in a few sentences and why she inspired you, what would you say?
Well, I would say that she's a personally admirable and remarkable woman, who in both her intellectual thinking and her public campaigning combines and brings together the best of radical individualism and liberalism on the one hand, and radical feminism and a concern for equality between the sexes on the other. And what we should really take from this more than anything else, I think, is that there is a kind of natural affinity between the two, and that the kind of division which is often postulated today between a concern for equality between sexes and liberal ideas is actually false, and that what Josephine Butler's career shows is that the two things necessarily go together.
Well, Dr. Steve Davis, thank you very much for joining us today. Can I thank our viewers and listeners for joining us? If you would like more information on our publications, on our webinars, and our other online content, please check out our YouTube channel, IA London. You can also listen to our podcasts on Podbean. And to help us keep providing free content during these tough times, please do consider making a contribution, no matter how modest. And you can do this by donating online at ia.org.uk. Thank you for watching or listening today. We hope that you'll join us again soon. Thank you.